Here before, let me just review the ground rules with you briefly. This case is set for 30 minutes per side pursuant to our order granting extended oral argument. The appellant may reserve whatever part of the 30 minutes you wish for rebuttal, if any. Would remind counsel you don't need to use all the time allotted if you don't wish to. We've read the briefs in your cases. We're familiar with the facts as you set them forth. So to the extent you want to proceed directly to your legal argument, that's fine with us. We would ask you to stay close to the podium because we're recording your arguments and we can go back and listen to them only if your voice is picked up by the microphone. Feel free to adjust the podium by a toggle switch that moves up and down. If anybody has a cell phone, please ensure it's turned off. And you will be guided by the lighting system that counts backwards. So if you look at the time on the podium, you'll see it's counting backwards from 30, which will tell you how much time you have left. We're ready when you are, counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Chris Forsyth, registration 22608, here on behalf of appellant Rosario Aviado. I will be looking to reserve at least 10 minutes for rebuttal. The court directed us in a recent order to address a motion issue in oral argument, so to make sure I get that addressed before we get to more substantive issues, I would like to do that first and briefly. The court directed us whether the 30-day period by statute 843-309 is jurisdictional or directory, was the court's order. I do have a response to that. First, whether it's directory or jurisdictional, I don't think bears completely on the way we've argued the issue. I will get to that issue. But under the Workers' Compensation Act and under the two cases, D Enterprises and MGM Supply, and under the statute, there's this bargain for exchange in the Workers' Compensation Act. In other words, the legislature expressly stated these parties are given up common law rights in exchange for these provisions, the statutes. Now, I emphasize common law rights, which we'll get to later. It doesn't say we give up constitutional rights. It says common law rights. But in that context, and under the opinions, I believe the act is construed as a contract. If you look at that, if you believe the language and believe the courts, that there was this bargain for exchange. Therefore, I look at the 30-day term for the court as an essential binding term of the contract. And that's how it was initially argued, is that the 30 days was an initial binding term of the contract.
So what happens if we don't do it in 30 days? I mean, let's assume it's, I don't care whether you call it a binding term of a contract or a statute. What is the remedy if we don't decide in 30 days? Send it back to the district court? It's never been to the district court.
Correct. So I believe it goes to district court. It should be, and now I'll get into your specific direction, because that's where that point heads. Under 843-309, it says it shall be heard within 30 days after issue shall be joined. You cited some cases that said, here these are directory, okay? Those cases, however, did not contain the next provision in the statute, which is, unless continued on order of the court for good cause shown, no continuance shall be longer than 30 days at one time. So there is a provision for the court to extend the time. Now, is there a provision, as you have pointed out, Judge Roy, that exactly what happens if it fails? No, there is not.
Okay, wouldn't the most logical thing be that the lower tribunal is affirmed? The appellate court having lost jurisdiction to act, the hearing having occurred in the administrative agency, I realize you don't want it there, but the hearing held in the administrative agency, appellate court appeal brought, appellate court loses jurisdiction. Isn't the most logical remedy that the administrative agency's decision is affirmed?
No, because she has a right to judicial review of an order or the access to the courts. In other words, she has the right at some point to have a judge rule on the case. So no, I disagree with that contention. And I wandered over here, and after I received your order, I was concerned that one of you would come up with that sort of contention based on the judicial animosity towards administrative law judges. in the judicial branch. I don't think that contention is supported by the Constitution. Access to courts, she has the right to a judicial branch judge. The fact that the judicial review wasn't timely given, however, I think under the contractual issue of the Act, shows that the Act was not complied with and she should get her original hearing in front of a district court. Also, I point out the Colorado Appellate Rules, Rule 3.1 provides appeals from orders and awards of the Industrial Claim Appeals Office shall be in the manner and within the time prescribed by statute. Therefore, the Court of Appeals states it will comply with the statute that the Workers' Compensation Act provides. Furthermore, case law shows that the judicial review provisions in the Act are completely definitive and organic without the need for supplementation from other legislative acts. That was a cite from Gardner versus Freehan, 849 P2D 817, Colorado Appeals, 1992. Furthermore, filing requirements in workers' compensation are jurisdictional. That's under Digital Equipment Corporation versus ICAP, 894 P2D 54, Colorado Appeals, 1995. Non-existent provisions cannot be read into the statute regarding excusable neglect, which was argued in that case. In other words, they filed an appeal. I believe in that case it was within 3 days mailing, and they determined that the 3 days mailing didn't apply in the workers' compensation context. They would not provide an excusable neglect rationale to the attorney in the case. So the question in that case is, why is it any different when a judicial deadline is at issue?
And let me just understand, apart from your contract theory, breach of contract, your argument is on its face, this is a jurisdictional provision, that the court does not hear the case within 30 days of that issue, that the court loses jurisdiction?
Correct. The cases you cited in the order that I looked up said that this sort of provision on its face appears to be mandatory. But then the courts hedged away from that and said, unless legislative intent is otherwise, we're going to say it's directional.
Let me ask you this. Have you seen a case decided by the Colorado Supreme Court last week, In re Fisher?
I'm sorry, I have not.
That was and I don't mean to be springing it on you, it was a case in which the hearing board, it was the outside workers' comp hearing board, attorney discipline, says you have to rule within 60 days. And the attorney hearing board did not rule within 60 days. I believe it was 96 days. Okay. The Supreme Court said that that deadline is merely aspirational and it's not jurisdictional. And so I would say, in any event, I just toss it out for your consideration. It just came down last week. But on your breach of contract argument, is your argument that any violation of a procedural provision in the Workers' Comp Act therefore breaches the contract and therefore what the remedy is therefore the whole workers' comp statute is thrown out the board? Or how do you limit your kind of breach of contract theory so it's not applicable to every procedural violation?
Not necessarily. It's the timeliness that's at issue. In regard to the attorney discipline case, the next point I'm about to arrive at was in the case is exactly the same as in the cases you've already provided. They said unless there's an intent of the legislature to show that this is jurisdictional, we're not going to hold this sort of provision jurisdictional. And my guess is, because I haven't read the cases, that's the same gist of the order you just mentioned, that it's no different from the two you've already cited. However, in the Workers' Compensation Act, there is a provision that I point out to you that shows that time is of the essence in workers' compensation matters. That is Colorado Revised Statute 84102. It provides that it is the intent of the General Assembly that the Workers' Compensation Act of Colorado be interpreted so as to assure the quick and efficient delivery of disability and medical benefits. In other words, time was of the essence. That's the whole reason they created this system, supposedly, was to take out necessary litigation and get benefits to folks quickly. There are two points to this statute. First, I contend it says time is of the essence. Second, the court knows how to say, or the legislature, excuse me, knows how to say quick when it means quick, and it knows how to say 30 days when it means 30 days. And they're two different provisions.
So, Mr. Forsyth, what prejudice has your client suffered since she didn't get awarded permanent total disability benefits?
She has been, you know, and I meant to time, we've been fighting for this for years now. And she didn't get timely review under the Workers' Compensation Act. If indeed she's due the benefits, which if she's due them, they are a constitutionally protected property right.
But she'd, we get interest on those benefits if they had not previously been awarded, correct?
If the judge ordered that, correct.
So wouldn't that make her whole?
No, because she's out here day by day sitting without a check. She's harmed every day. I mean, I can't begin to tell you.
Well, let's assume the decision goes against you. How is she harmed under those circumstances? If we were to say the ALJ didn't abuse his discretion in limiting the testimony, that the error, if any, was harmless, and we were to reject your constitutional arguments, she would lose the case. How would she be prejudiced by the failure to get a ruling within 30 days?
Because the question would be, if she had gotten a ruling within 30 days, would it have been different? Would there have been something provided to her more quickly? Would she have prevailed? I don't think you can erase the error of untimeliness. In this particular case, I specifically note it was Judge Davidson who denied the motion. I mean, no offense, but the court was put on fair notice. The motion was saying, please comply with the statute.
Well, that goes to whether it's breached or not, but that's not specifically answering my question, which is, if your client were to lose, what harm would she have suffered by virtue of the fact that we didn't get this decision out to you in 30 days?
If she, well, we don't believe she's gotten a fair, timely hearing.
Yeah, and that's the word you just used. You don't construe the statute to say she has a right to a ruling within 30 days. We could have heard this case, could we not, in October, and sat on it and deliberated for 6 months. Would that violate the statute? The verb is heard, is it not?
Shall be heard within 30 days after issue shall be joined.
And we're hearing it today. Would you agree? Your position is not that we have to rule within 30 days, is it? If it is, how does that square with the statute?
That's a reasonable question that I hadn't anticipated coming. I believe it can cut either way. First of all, are you hearing it today? Sure you are. You're hearing oral arguments today, and I assume the briefs have been reviewed. But I believe heard could be construed to also mean that it shall be ruled on once you read this provision in with 840.102, which provides for the quick, efficient delivery of disability and medical benefits. So, in other words, I believe that the statute provides time is of the essence. I believe the motion's proven, and I believe that the requested result, that we go to district court, is the logical result, although, as you point out, it is not provided for in the statute. I'd like to move into the other issues.
Just one further follow-up
okay.
on that. Wouldn't the requested remedy actually cause more delay to your client? What do you want the district court to do? We send it back. What do you want the instructions to? Not send it back, actually, as Judge Roy pointed out. It's not send it back. You craft an order for us under your proposed remedy. We've lost jurisdiction, therefore, district court, do what?
District court, you hear the case on the merits from its very beginning. I think the findings of the workers' compensation, well, of the Office of Administrative Courts are null and void because the judicial review provisions were not complied with in the statute. She has
so therefore have discovery and have just a common law tort claim?
No, I'm not arguing that the whole Workers' Compensation Act would be negated. I don't think that that's, I guess you could argue that, but the only thing we're arguing, I mean, the remedy goes specifically with the problem, and that she wasn't given timely benefits in front of a judge, in front of a district court or a judicial branch entity. So in no way, shape, or form in this action are we contesting the Workers' Compensation Act.
No, so I'm just trying to clarify your request for a remand. We've got to tell the district court something because I would suspect the district court has never seen a remand order like the one you're asking for.
The remand order.
It's not a remand order, really. It's a kind of a new jurisdiction order. But what does it say? What does the district court have to do?
It would say that the Workers' Compensation Act is not the exclusive, or the Office of Administrative Courts does not have exclusive jurisdiction over the Workers' Compensation Act in this particular case. The judiciary provisions providing for judicial review were violated. Therefore, we declare that Ms. Aviato is allowed to obtain a hearing on the merits of all issues in front of a judicial officer.
Is that a trial?
Yes.
A trial de novo?
Yes.
And isn't there discovery that would normally be incident to that trial, or just going to go back and on day, within the 30-day period, just have a trial without any discovery? Is that what she wants?
No, I mean, there would be, I imagine there would be brief discovery, that both parties will go out and brief discovery to amend whatever findings. We didn't have any real discovery issues below.
Well, I guess my question or point is that it's going to lead, your requested remedy is actually going to lead to a more drawn out process than the one you're complaining has already been too drawn out.
I don't believe that's necessarily true. I understand your contention and where you're coming from, but knowing how this case is posed and knowing how district courts and Office of Administrative Courts work, I don't anticipate that it will be any longer than if we just go back to the Office of Administrative Courts.
Let's explore that a minute. I know you want to get on to other issues, but you've now had a hearing. It may be a late hearing, but you're likely to have an answer within 3 to 4 weeks.
That would be nice.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, how does that compare with what you would expect going back to the district court, recognizing that to get to the district court under this scenario, you have to go through all this first and then be late up here and then go back to the district court for trial de novo?
I understand completely what you're saying. However, as you know, I'm an attorney. I have to request the appropriate relief that my client will obtain. Here, the orders below were against her, so it's my job to argue that that's not appropriate and that she's entitled to a hearing before a judge.
Okay, let's go to the proceedings below.
Okay.
What were you seeking there? Full disability, 100% disability?
Permanent total disability benefits, that's correct.
Now, what evidence was there in the record in that hearing to support a finding of permanent total disability?
The work restrictions provided by the treating physician, the vocational testimony of expert Tony Manuel, claimant's testimony, all the evidence that was
in. Did anyone testify she was permanently and totally disabled?
Well, usually that testimony is not specifically elicited. Usually the testimony is that she's unable to earn a wage, which is the requirement under the statute. And yes, that testimony was elicited from Tony Manuel, and he drafted that in his reports. So the answer to your question is yes. In moving on to the more substantive issues below, I'd like to first address the affirmative defense the judge relied on. I believe there's a case right on point. It's Maxey versus Jefferson County, 408 PTD 970. In that case, a trial court judge used an affirmative defense that was not ruled on, that was not affirmatively pled and proven, and he was reversed. I don't believe in any way, shape, or form that this can be called harmless error, as the Industrial Claims Appeals Panel itself interjected into the case. The statute for harmless error questions whether she's damaged thereby. Obviously, from the written findings of the judge, she was damaged by the judge using the affirmative defense against her. He said, viewed in the light, her decision to decline the surgery was objectively unreasonable and serves to bar a claim for permanent total disability benefits. Furthermore, he found, indeed as found, claimant could not unreasonably refuse recommended surgery, which would more than likely render her capable of earning wages, and claim lifetime permanent total disability benefits. And the converse of that is, well, if it would render her likely capable of earning her wages, then she's not capable of earning them now. Those express findings by the judge undermine any argument that this is harmless error by any stretch of the imagination. It is as improper as a juror failing to follow or following a wrong instruction by a judge or failing to follow the instructions, which the court overturns those cases. If the judge gives the wrong instruction in the case gets overturned, assuming it was a substantive issue. Here it's a very substantive issue. It's an affirmative defense that bars recovery.
Let me use your analogy a little bit. If there are two claims for relief in a district court case and there's an error as to instruction on one, but there's no error as to instruction on the other, and the identical relief is accorded, the improper instruction will not have affected a claimant's right under those circumstances, correct?
Possibly under those circumstances. I don't see that rationale applying in this case because the claim was permanent total disability benefits.
But there were a whole host of findings about ability to earn wages that the court, or that the ALJ would not have had to go into if the sole basis for his determination was that this affirmative defense barred her claim. So in other words, he made a lot of findings that she could earn wages, and that would have been irrelevant had he hung his hat solely upon the issue of the affirmative defense.
I disagree with that analysis because the affirmative defense is not relevant unless we've made a case that she's unable to earn a wage. In other words, he should not have gone into, if that was the case, he should not have gone into the affirmative defense at all. He didn't get there in the analysis if that was the case. But the affirmative defense statute in this case specifically provides that you don't get there unless the claimant has shown that she's, you know, got a case, that she's permanently and totally disabled. Only then does the affirmative defense come into play. Simply by putting the affirmative defense in the order, which wasn't pled or proven, he's shown that she was permanently and totally disabled legally because otherwise the affirmative defense has not arisen. The next issue, the evidentiary ruling affecting a substantial right. The FCE at issue was used by the respondents to argue that it was in compliance with the doctor's rationale. You might be looking at that and getting glazed eyes. The important thing about that was repetitive motion. Okay, whether somebody can do repetitive motion or not is very important in finding a job, especially when you get into the light sedentary categories, because they're usually computer jobs or job ticket jobs where repetitive motion is an issue. That's the whole reason that's so important, because the FCE got away from the repetitive motion and wanted to construe, if you read their experts' reports, she's actually negated the repetitive motion requirement by attempting to construe the doctor's statement regarding repetitive motion to essentially mean repetitive motion's okay. And the problem was they never let her go back to the doctor to allow him to comment on that FCE. They wouldn't let her go back. Yet then they went to hearing and argued that this would be his finding. And then at hearing, they objected to any testimony or evidence regarding the lack of a doctor's appointment with their failure to allow her to go back to the doctor to get his opinion on this FCE.
Well, the doctor's opinion was available outside of that, was it not? I mean, you could have taken the report to the doctor outside the workman's comp, gotten his opinion, and put him on.
If the client could pay for that, that is correct. But under the Workers' Compensation Act, she was getting benefits from the respondents. So they were paying for medical appointments. So unless she could afford that relief, no, she can't go back to the doctor because they wouldn't authorize it.
So it's a funding issue. It's not that the evidence is not available. As a practical matter, it's that the client cannot afford to pay the doctor to review the report and express an opinion.
Right. If the doctor, you have to understand the doctors get authorized, and if the insurance company won't authorize the visit, they're very hesitant to see the claimant. That's just the way it is.
Well, I understand the funding mechanism, but she could go to him for private care, and they couldn't stop him from doing it.
If he would accept that. Not all doctors accept private care.
Yeah, I know.
So, I mean, if he would accept that, arguably. But given the time constraints of hearing, that wasn't a feasibility. The FCE, HealthSouth FCE, as you can see in the record, came out very late, right before hearing. We requested the relief timely. It wasn't provided. There wasn't any more time to get to the doctor, to get an appointment, to do anything. We assumed we would just argue that he didn't review it.
Now, this doctor you wanted to go back to had concluded, and I don't want to argue about small percentages, but approximately 10% disability.
I think that's
7
right.
Or something like that, but about 10%.
Right, whether she's permanently and totally disabled comes down to work restrictions, what she can do. And she is permanently and totally disabled because she can't do stuff with her hands. and I would like to, at least for a few minutes, get to the really substantive issue, which is the constitutional requirements of administrative law judges. I stand here before you with full belief that the current system is not constitutional. In fact, I believe it so much, I fail to see how there is any argument that the current system is constitutional. One needs only reading comprehension and a slice of integrity to see that the current provision allowing the Office of Administrative Courts to hear and decide these cases is unconstitutional. Article 6, Section 9.
Now, this would be a broad-based constitutional that would say the same thing for the PUC, it would say the same thing for any other agency that has judicial resolves disputes, has a judicial system of some sort.
No, I completely disagree.
Okay. It's only limited to workman's comp?
Absolutely, because workers' compensation arises at common law. The right to sue an employer arises at common law. It's written into the act. In the enterprises where Judge Davidson wrote otherwise, that's not true. Where other opinions have simply stated that, you know, these specific rights were not available, they're correct. They're codification. However, the substantive right was available at common law. Therefore, the United States Supreme Court, if we get up to the United States Supreme Court, will say that this is unconstitutional because of the Crowell v. Benson case, the Grand Financiera v. Norberg case, and the Thomas case, which the judge all used in the D. Enterprises case.
And your argument would strike down workers' comp situations around the country?
No. And that's a very good point. I'm very glad you raised that. You have to understand that workers' compensation is an administrative remedy that's done differently in every state. Just because it's done a certain way in Colorado does not mean it's done a certain way in another state. Each one is different, and they are completely different.
No, but if you're going to take it to the U.S. Supreme Court, you're going to have a federal question.
Regarding state law?
Well, no, regarding, no, they're not going to interpret state law. As far as I know, if you get them to do it, that's good for you, but they're going to have to interpret the federal constitution and say that the federal constitution prohibits Colorado from operating the system this way. And I guess my question to you is, if they do that, then what is the dividing line between Colorado and every other state that runs a workers' comp situation? What do we do different in Colorado than other states?
It's possible that if the state provides an administrative remedy, in other words, if the benefits come from the state of Colorado rather than a private party, I think it's theoretically possible that the Supreme Court of the United States could derive a distinction in that case. In this case, however, it is clear from the cases they have decided that workers' compensation arises at common law. Therefore, the right to the district court cannot be waived. It's a constitutional right that cannot be waived pursuant to the statute.
It's a Seventh Amendment federal constitutional right?
Either under equal protection or Article 3.
Article 3 of the federal constitution?
Yes, because, let me make sure I got that right. The equal protection is United States Constitution, Fifth and 14th Amendment. Under the United States Constitution, the separation of powers arguments is derived from case law, going back to Marbury versus Madison. And this is another extremely good point. The United States Constitution doesn't expressly state anywhere the separation of powers doctrine. It's defined from case law, okay? Colorado, however, which can have a constitution.
I would challenge that premise. You got Article 1, 2, and 3 separate the powers among three branches of government. So I don't know where you're going with that.
Correctly, that's the interpretation. Each one's
not interpretation. It's explicit in the Constitution.
Right. They say in each one it says we have these powers. However, it's not as expressly stated as it is in the Colorado Constitution, Article 6, Section 9, where it says, in Article 3, where it says, no person or collection of persons charged with the exercise of powers properly belonging to one of these dark departments shall exercise any, emphasize any, power properly belonging to either of the others, except as in this Constitution expressly directed or permitted. This language has been avoided by every court before you. Every court has gone into this lump analysis and said, Article 3, like the United States Constitution. The United States Constitution does not contain this provision, except as expressly provided herein. Where is it provided in the Colorado Constitution that the Office of Administrative Courts can exercise judicial functions? It doesn't. It's as plain as day. If you read expressly the Constitution, you cannot hold that the Office of Administrative Courts is constitutional. I've used way too much of my time, and I'd like to remain or retain the few minutes remaining for rebuttal.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Scott Busser, and I'm here on behalf of the respondents below. Mr. Forsyth has raised a number of issues, and I'll try to deal with them in the same sequence as he dealt with them. First of all, with regards to the Section 843.309 argument, looking at the DeMarco decision, looking at the Burns decision, and actually looking at a more recent decision after that, which would be the Langton versus Rocky Mountain Healthcare Corporation, the language of the statute is directory, not jurisdictional. There's no alternative or else language contained within the statute. And a helpful contrast for that would be Section 843.301, dealing with appeals. 843.301 sub 1 specifically states that you have 20 days from the date an order is mailed in order to perfect an appeal, or else the order shall become final. Further, in 843.301, if you look at sub 8 and sub 11, dealing with appeals to the Industrial Claim Appeals Office, the Industrial Claim Appeals Office has 60 days in which to issue an order. The statute very, very clearly lays out what is to happen if the Industrial Claim Appeals Office fails to execute its statutory function. Basically, of course, it provides for an appeal to the Court of Appeals and sets forth the time frames for dissatisfied parties to perfect their appeal. I think the best language, though, addressing this sort of issue is in the Langton decision. In Langton, there was a statutory provision that said administrative law judges shall issue orders within 15 days of completion of the record or completion of the hearing. And in that case, the claimant argued because the judge didn't order, enter an order within 15 days, the judge was deprived of jurisdiction. And if I can quote just very briefly from Judge Metzger's decision, she stated, "The General Assembly has declared that the Workers' Compensation Act should be interpreted so as to assure the quick and efficient delivery of disability and medical benefits to injured workers at a reasonable cost to employers." Then there's a citation. "The obvious purpose of the 15-day provision is to expedite the process of appeals from the ALJ's initial determination of benefits. However, if, as claimant suggested, the 15-day period in Section 843.215 were construed as jurisdictional, an otherwise correct decision would be vacated. This would require a new hearing involving additional delay and expense for all parties before another ALJ. Clearly, such a result would be contrary to the quick, efficient, and low-cost delivery of benefits to injured workers." And that language was true in Langton and even more true today. Judge Connolly, you asked Mr. Forsyth about the order of remand, which you would tell a district court. There's no provision in the Workers' Compensation Act which addresses remands to any other entity than the Industrial Claim Appeals Panel and the administrative law judges. One thing that Mr. Forsyth did mention is, what district court are we supposed to send it to? I believe claimant may be a resident of Adams County. The employer may be Jefferson County. The insurer is in arguably in Arapahoe County. The hearing took place in Denver County. There's simply no basis for the relief sought by claimant. And I think the Artcraft sign case is very clear. You cannot read non-existent provisions into the Workers' Compensation Act.
Well, assuming that his remedy has some viability, wouldn't we just vacate these proceedings and grant him leave to bring an action in the district court?
Well, again, looking at the Langton decision, what you're asking for there, or what he's asking for, is rather than accept a modest delay in the proceedings before the Court of Appeals, to go back to square one and take whatever time is necessary in front of a district court. And to be honest, Your Honors, I don't practice in district court. I have professional partners who do, and I don't know the amount of time it takes. I know in talking with them, it takes quite a bit of time. And the time that claimant's asking for would be do serious damage to Section 840.102. But beyond that, claimant's complaint, as all of the filings in this case indicate, is with the court, system of the state of Colorado, particularly the appellate court system. Respondents below did their job. Claimant presented evidence. Respondents presented evidence. Judge Felter considered the evidence and decided that our evidence was more persuasive than claimant's. We have not created any situation. We've played by the rules. And what claimant is asking for is for us to be penalized for something that we did not do and that is beyond our control. But the interesting point also is there was a question or comment during Mr. Forsythe's presentation as to what the 30 days actually means. I mean, the 30 days, a case shall be heard. Well, as the court well knows, not every case that is filed with the Court of Appeals has oral argument. So what exactly is the meaning of the word heard? Is it when it is assigned to a panel? Is it when it's scheduled in terms of the scheduling? Is it when the first memo is prepared within the court? I can't answer that. But I do know it does not say, and there's no case interpreting that provision. And the in terms of the scholarly articles addressing it, there is one article from 1990 from an attorney, Craig Ely, and the Colorado Lawyer, which mentions it in passing as part of a summary of appellate process in Colorado, and he merely just cites to the statute without any sort of analysis as to how it was implemented. So I don't think, first of all, that the statute is jurisdictional. Second, I don't think there's any provision for the remedy sought by Mr. Forsythe. And third, I don't think he's been able to establish a case that there is, in fact, a violation of Section 843.309. Now, with regards to his argument regarding the questioning of claimant, and he's referring to the respondents wouldn't let claimant go back to see Dr. Hawk. There was one question. Mr. Forsythe asked his client, did the respondents let you see Dr. Hawk? I objected because there's no relevance to that question. In fact, looking at the transcript, the judge accepted Mr. Forsythe's statement or representation that the respondents did not agree to allow claimant to go back to see Dr. Hawk. That was the only question. There was no other record made by Mr. Forsythe. There was no offer of proof made by Mr. Forsythe. There was one question and one question only that in which the judge sustained my objection to the relevance of a question. And he has not shown how that was error. The third issue that Mr. Forsythe raised was the affirmative, what he refers to as the affirmative defense. And I think, Judge Casebolt, you had it, I think it was your question to Mr. Forsyth, which talked about if you had two theories and one of them didn't work as far as what happens otherwise. I think that was the point you were making. And I think that's a good point to reflect on here. There are two, respondents had multiple defenses, but the basic element is, does the claimant meet her burden of proving, more likely than not, that she is incapable of earning any wages? Assuming she did that, then if there were affirmative defenses pled, then they would kick in. Here, Judge Felter entered a number of findings that the claimant was, in fact, capable of earning any wages. Therefore, she did not meet the basic eligibility criteria for permanent total disability. And therefore, any issues as to affirmative defenses are effectively rendered moot. Now, I know.
Is that determination of permanent total disability made primarily based upon testimony of experts who so testify? Or is it, as Mr. Forsyth characterizes it, is there was evidence of this and evidence of that? And that is, I mean, the evidence that she couldn't do this, she couldn't.
It's a combination of factors. As Your Honor knows, permanent total disability is a pretty controversial topic in workers' comp. And what you had was testimony from Ms. Aviato as to what she could and couldn't do. You had testimony from, or rather, you had documentary evidence in the form of medical records, FCEs, and vocational reports. And you had live testimony from Tony Manuel, who was Mr. Forsyth, the expert hired by Mr. Forsyth, and respondents expert Meg Elder. And they rendered opinions as to what she could and couldn't do. And Judge Felter weighed that evidence and decided that the testimony of Ms. Elder was more persuasive than the testimony offered by Tony Manuel. Okay. So a lot goes into the mix. But I think, as Judge Casebolt was noting, if you were going in solely on affirmative ruling on affirmative defenses, there would have been no need for any other factual findings as to her capabilities or her abilities to work. But one thing beyond that, though, is we believe, and we've briefed it, I'm not going to beat a dead horse over it, we believe that it was harmless error. But even more than that was invited error. Mr. Forsyth repeatedly in his brief kept referring to the reasonable refusal of Ms. Aviato's reasonable refusal to have surgery. I never raised declination of surgery at hearing. During the course of the hearing. I never raised it before the hearing. I got Mr. Forsyth's position statement. He repeatedly referred to her reasonable refusal. Well, the reasonableness or unreasonableness of a refusal or declination of medical treatment is relevant for only one issue, and that is whether the claimant unreasonably refused and therefore would be barred from benefits. Mr. Forsyth raised it. Whether he intended to or not, I don't know. But I saw that, and then I figured he raised the issue, and therefore I responded to it. I responded to that, as well as the other issue is the basic underlying question of whether claimant was capable or incapable of earning any wages. So I think if there was error, it was harmless or invited on the part of claimant. Now, with regards to...
You could very well stand here and disclaim any interest in that defense.
Pardon?
You could say here you disclaim any interest.
Absolutely.
In that defense, and you rely on the other findings.
I rely on the judge's findings. I mean, the discussion of her declination is unnecessary. Judge Felter found that she was, in fact, capable of earning any wages and therefore was not entitled to permanent total disability benefits. The final issues that Mr. Forsyth raised were the constitutionality arguments. And having a little hard, a bit of a hard time following Mr. Forsythe's arguments. He mentions, he talks about separation of powers. My understanding with regards to the separation of powers argument is that, and I believe it, it's a case that we're all taught in law school, or was taught in law school when I went to school, Northern Pipe or the Marathon case, and Marathon in the bankruptcy courts. And it's whether an administrative agency is exercising complete judicial authority. And here, as the D Enterprises case noted, and its predecessor, I believe it was the M&M case, or MGM, I'm sorry, is that administrative law judges employed by, at that time, the Division of Administrative Hearings, did not exercise judicial authority because ultimately any order or determination by an administrative law judge or the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation is only enforceable, ultimately enforceable, through a district court proceeding. Nothing has changed since then. Judge Roy, I note you seem a little startled by that, but there's a provision in the Act that if there is noncompliance with an order, the ultimate remedy for any dissatisfied party, particularly an order directing payment of benefits, is to take a certified copy to the district court, have it entered as a judgment, and to proceed through normal enforcement mechanisms, just as you would enforce any other judgment. That is ultimately a judicial act, and that is the judicial act which keeps the current workers' comp administrative structure or adjudication structure from being an unconstitutional delegation of power.
Let me ask you, that act, though, is one of enforcement, not of adjudication, is it not?
Well, ultimately, all comes down to enforcement. My understanding is in the D Enterprises case, it ultimately came down to that in terms of the enforcement.
The only court that, in any event, in any way adjudicates these claims is the appellate courts on a petition for review. Is that not right?
And you're talking in terms of what is euphemistically referred to as an Article III court?
No, I don't think so. I'm talking about in terms of, you say a district court enforces the order of the ALJ.
Well, and of course the appellate courts, but the appellate court would be affirming, reversing, modifying an order below.
It's the only court reviewing the merits of a controversy.
Correct. Correct. And I believe that's what the General Assembly had intended when they modified the appellate provisions back in 1969. Which actually, at that point, specifically deprived the district courts of appellate jurisdiction and placed that jurisdiction within, at that time, the recreated Colorado Court of Appeals. So I don't see the only thing that has, Mr. Forsythe made these arguments in the D Enterprises case, all of these arguments in the D Enterprises case several years ago, the only thing that has changed since then, since that point in time, is that now instead of the administrative law judges being within the Division of Administrative Hearings in the Department of Personnel and Administration, is they are now within the Office of Administrative Courts within the Department of Personnel and Administration. And I think that is a difference, a distinction without a difference. What you had was several of the directors, Director Williams, Director Azar, and former DPA Director Jeffrey Wells, trying to improve the standards by which administrative law judges enter their orders, express their orders, and any effort to try to improve the quality of those decisions certainly cannot serve as the basis for finding those actions to be less than constitutional. Unless the court has some additional questions, I'll yield back the balance of my time. Thank you.
Mr.
If I may, I would briefly move for more time. I didn't anticipate till I got back from vacation on Monday that I would be spending any time on motions in this oral argument, as I was directed by the court upon order. Briefly, it's incorrect to say benefits can only be enforced by district court. First of all, the penalty statute where he's quoting from says you may take it to the district court. It's not required. The other statute allows...
How do you get it then? How does the director of workers' comp or the panel enforce their order? They say, okay, we're going to award penalties of $2,000. How do you get it if the carrier or the employer says...
Because then they can keep doing orders for penalties. In other words, that's the whole point. They can penalize a party for failing to comply with their order, which is, in its essence, contempt. And the statute specifically provides for that.
You can't be jailed for it, though.
No, you're correct. They can't.
Well, you can't garnish the bank, or you can't garnish the insurance carrier or the recalcitrant party with an administrative order. You need basically a court order to do that.
That's a fair assessment, but they can assess penalties, which is contempt, which has been stated previously as the rationale for saying they're not really judges. Yeah, that's just not true. They decide the case in every sense of the word. And I point back to Article 3 of the Colorado Constitution, which says any judicial power. In other words, if there's any judicial power exercised by the legislative branch or the executive branch, it's not appropriate unless expressly provided in the Constitution. Any is an important word. In other words, an opinion that says that isn't really using that word any that's in the Colorado Constitution. That's not a good interpretation of the Constitution. It means what it says. And any power exercised by one of the other departments should not be used by the other unless expressly provided herein. It's as clear and as plain as day. The Colorado Constitution requires, if you're going to do this and do this system, there's got to be an amendment to the Constitution that says it so. Indeed, the legislature itself tried to correct this issue and placed them in the judicial branch. And that did not happen because the judicial branch opposed it. In regard to the other issues brought up by counsel, the affirmative defense is not harmless in any way, shape, or form. It's as if you have a juror in the trial of a black man who says, you know, I'm not a racist, but then you find out they're a Ku Klux Klan member and they voted to convict the guy, okay? Then, you know, that's not going to hold water because he held a bias against the guy that he shouldn't have. It's the same difference in this case. The ALJ held against the claimant the fact that she didn't have surgery. Then he went into findings about how reasonable the surgery was and what the chances of recovery would be. There was never testimony regarding that. Nothing in the record. He created it all.
There was no record. There's nothing in the record about the success rate?
No. There's this brought out interpretation regarding a percentage in one report that the testimony was never sought because it wasn't an issue. We didn't have the opportunity to expound on those issues, to raise those testimonies. If that was going to be an issue, what the chances of success were, you know, the fact that, you know, is she really going to have work restrictions after the surgery, which the answer would be yes. Would the restrictions be about the same as the ones she had even without the surgery? The answer would be yes, as pointed out by the division IME physician. He actually did point out, you know, hey, I don't think you should have this surgery because I don't think there's going to be a reasonable chance of that much recovery. And nevertheless, the ALJ says, you know, I'm going to hold this against you, and it's not reasonable for you to request permanent total disability benefits when this surgery would render you capable of earning wages. I fail to see how any reasonable person could say that's harmless error. He held that against her. She deserves a hearing in front of a fair tribunal, one that won't hold an improper affirmative defense against her. The light's been red for a little while, and I appreciate your time. I would like to say I fully respect the court. I believe the court has integrity. I have to believe in the system or else I wouldn't be practicing law anymore. And I know I filed motions that are contentious. I don't intend to offend any one of you individually. However, the judicial branch, which wasn't you at the time, has lobbied on this issue. And I don't know, I did file a motion for reconsideration of your previous order. It was filed this morning. You probably don't have that yet. But there is an appearance of impropriety here. I stand before a body determining the case when that body as a whole has argued against it, lobbied against it, done everything in its power to stop what I'm here arguing for. So what's this all about? I'm counting on your integrity. That's what this is all about.
And is it not possible to rule against you on the merits and still have integrity?
I don't think it's possible to simply say that D Enterprises and MGM's supply were correctly decided and have integrity. I think you have to look through and come up with your own analysis. In other words, it needs to be looked at completely and thoroughly as brief. If you do so, I'm confident you only have one conclusion, that according to the Colorado Constitution, which is the Colorado and the United States Supreme Court Constitution, which, as he cited, the Northern Pipeline case is binding on this case and gives you the result. The Enterprises says that's not the case. But I'm confident that you'll reach a just conclusion that on more than one level, Ms. Aviato prevails in this appeal. Thank you very much for your time and consideration.
Thank you, counsel. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course. That concludes our docket for the afternoon. The court will be in recess. The bailiff may so announce.
All rise. The court will be in recess, subject to call.